You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Americans have been debating the use of big data in law enforcement, healthcare, finance, and the sciences. Less attention has been paid to new technology and data in entertainment. But given the time we devote to video and music, the evolution of entertainment may have a greater influence on our day-to-day lives than many of the applications that have caused greater concern. In Streaming, Sharing, Stealing, Big Data, and the Future of Entertainment, which is published by MIT Press, Carnegie Mellon professors Michael Smith and Rahul Talang.
That's exactly right.
Study the shift in power and profit in entertainment, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Michael Smith to our show today. Hello.
Very nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Which companies are leading the way in entertainment?
I think the interesting shift we're seeing right now is for the past 100 years, six major studios have led the way in entertainment, and their power has persisted in spite of massive shifts in technology. And now we're seeing Netflix and Amazon and Google use their data to not only market the content, but also create their own original content. And that's just new.
Amazon was founded 22 years ago in 1994. Spotify has been around for just 10 years. How rapidly are their industries changing?
I think these industries are changing incredibly rapidly because they're facing not just a single shift in the market, but they're facing multiple shifts in the market.
And many now see Apple as a mature company, kind of like Ford or ExxonMobil. Haven't things become fairly stable for them?
For Apple?
Yeah.
Yeah, and some would argue too stable. It's been surprising to us that Apple hasn't taken more of a leadership role in creating the content and in doing the sorts of things you see these other tech firms becoming media firms doing.
But they have dabbled.
They have dabbled, but they haven't really jumped in with both feet like Amazon and Apple and Google.
You look at film and television, music and publishing in this book. How big a player are these, those three or some of the others involved? Hasn't publishing declined a lot?
Publishing, I think the publishing business has gotten much harder. If you think of the traditional publishing houses, but the amount of output being created has expanded enormously. You know, there are far more books today being written than ever before.
And romance novels, for example, sell in the many millions.
Romance novels sell in the many millions, and one of the things we talk about in the book is that part of that is the anonymity. You know, you used to have to go to that part of the store and hand it to a person at the checkout, and now you can get it without any human interaction and read it on your Kindle, and it's opened up a whole new genre.
There have been several reports on the poor summer for movies. Is that just an aberration, or could it be a sign that some of our old titans are also in decline or don't understand the market today?
One of the things we talk about in the book is how data is actually being used in the business and how much power knowing exactly my preferences and exactly your preferences is for the companies who own that. I think one of the risks the studios have is they really don't have any direct contact with individual customers in any of their channels.
And yet a company like Disney seems to do well while the others are suffering.
Disney has actually made some pretty interesting bets, particularly in their theme parks, on individual data. So Disney invested $1 billion to put RFID tags on people in their theme parks. So they know exactly what rides you go to, when you go to them, and they can use that not only to improve the theme park experience, but I think increasingly they might be able to use that to market their content.
And their movies do better than a lot of the major studios. Maybe they don't spend as much money on the blockbusters.
They have a nice defined niche. Unlike most of the other studios, which produce a general slate, when you think of Disney movies, you have a movie in mind, and you might actually, you know which movies are Disney movies, whereas Paramount or Warner Brothers, it's much harder.
The way you spot them is they made the bombs this summer.
It's tough, and I think, you know, some movies did really well, and then a lot of movies tanked. And what we're hearing from the people we work with in the studios is movies either do much better than you thought they'd do, or they do much worse than you thought they'd do. That the traditional prediction algorithms aren't working as well as they used to.
Many people expected the internet to democratize things. Has that proved to be the case?
I think it has, in the sense, not in the sense of blockbusters, but in the sense of just general entertainment, that now individual artists can get access to the channel, can bring their message to fans, and in some cases those individual artists develop a really strong fan following. My kids like a YouTube show called Epic Rap Battles of History, which is, you know, two comedians who take two historical characters and do a 5-minute sketch of a rap battle between them. You know, that's something that wouldn't work in the traditional channels, but seems to attract a lot of attention and a lot of engagement online.
And we're seeing a whole bunch of stars developing on YouTube and some of the other services.
The old process, when you had very limited distribution channels, was you had to decide up front, what do I think is going to be most successful? And then you promoted that. What we're seeing differently in YouTube is you can make everything available and then let the audience decide what they like. And you can also make much stronger niches, you know, that if I have a small audience and a small following, I can still find a nice niche for that online.
In the past, you had to convince a movie studio or a broadcast studio company, a network, to invest in you, and now you can just do it yourself as long as you can get a camera and access the internet.
This is one of the things we talk about in the book, is that, you know, why have six major studios, three major labels, five major publishing houses dominated their industry? Part of it was because they could control scarcity and how content was made, scarcity and how content was distributed, and they could use copyright law to control scarcity and how content was consumed. And none of those things are as scarce anymore, as you said.
How much influence does Hollywood wield in Washington? Hasn't Disney been a major force behind several extensions of copyright protection?
It has, and I think all of the industry is in favor of stronger copyright protection, and we've seen extensions and laws to try to strengthen copyright protection.
Is copyright law changing to reflect the industry changes?
I think it's
or trying to hold back the changes.
I think copyright law is adapting the more we understand about what is actually happening. So there are these myths out there that piracy doesn't hurt sales and it doesn't affect the business. And one of the points we're trying to make in the book is those are in fact myths. If you look at the data, there have been 25 peer-reviewed academic papers on whether piracy hurts sales, and 22 of them show piracy has a statistically and economically significant harmful effect.
You quote Steve Jobs, who said, "You'll never stop piracy, so what you have to do is compete with it." You're saying he was wrong?
No, I'm saying piracy definitely hurts sales. Then the question becomes, what do you do about that? And I think there are two things you can do. One is you can make the legal content easier to consume, and that's what Steve Jobs was saying, and the data show that that is in fact effective. If you make digital content easier to consume, some people shift from piracy to legal sales. The other thing you can do is make piracy harder to consume. You can shut down websites. You can put up legal risks. And the evidence shows that that is also effective.
Well, Steve Jobs got to start building what were called blue boxes, in effect pirating long-distance phone service.
Ironic, isn't it? Yes, you know, that a lot of these industries have started by creative reuse.
My guest is Michael D. Smith, who, with Rahul Tilang, has written Streaming, Sharing, Stealing, Big Data and the Future of Entertainment. You compare what's happening now in Hollywood to what happened in baseball in the late 1990s, the sort of thing that was described by Michael Lewis in his book Moneyball. How is Hollywood similar?
It's similar in the sense that baseball was an industry where decisions were made based on gut feel, and there was very little use of quantitative data to make decisions. And I think we're seeing many of the same culture clashes between the quantitative and the gut feel that Michael Lewis talks about in his book and his movie. one of the differences we try to point out in our book is that in baseball, the Oakland A's innovated on all these quantitative techniques, but the Yankees and the Red Sox and everybody else in the league caught up pretty quickly. We think it's going to be harder for the major studios to catch up in part because... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
In part because in baseball, all the teams had access to the same data, whereas in entertainment, Amazon, Netflix, Google, they're the ones who own the customer, and they don't share that data with anyone.
You quote a studio executive as saying a certain subscription service got really lucky with the first thing they launched. I'm assuming he was referring to Netflix. But so they see luck as a factor?
Luck has always been a factor in their business. It's always been about taking big risks on things that 90% of them are going to fail and 1% of them are going to turn out to be big hits. What we're trying to argue in our research and analysis is Netflix is actually playing a completely different game. Netflix isn't selling individual shows. Netflix is selling a platform of shows. So they don't play by the same economic rules as the established industry.
But they were really helped when they came out with House of Cards. Although that was an Americanization of a British series, many people saw it as almost a revolutionary kind of show.
It was revolutionary in the sense of how they greenlit the show. So instead of doing the traditional thing you do in television, asking the writers to make a pilot and then seeing whether that pilot worked and then approving it for 6 or 12 episodes, Netflix came in and said, here's $100 million, we'd like for you to make 2 seasons. The other thing that we talk about in the first chapter of the book is that it was revolutionary in the sense that it broke a lot of the mold of storytelling. So there's this wonderful book in movies that's called Save the Cat. And the argument is you need to introduce your main character by having them do something noble, but like saving a cat. House of Cards, Netflix introduced their main character by having him kill a dog. You know, it's almost the complete opposite of the traditional wisdom in the industry.
Netflix also produced Orange is the New Black and hasn't had other successes. Have they found a way of doing things that previous leaders like HBO haven't done? Because HBO seems to be one of the few of the old-timers that still succeeds.
Well, and HBO's made...
I guess Showtime to some degree as well.
And HBO's made this wonderful bet on getting direct access to their consumers. You know, HBO Go gives them the opportunity to understand what their online consumers are watching, when they're watching it, what shows they like. And they can, with that data, they can do a lot of the same things Netflix does in terms of promoting content directly to you based on what I know about your interests.
Aren't entertainment studios notoriously prone to what psychologists and economists call groupthink?
They are in the sense that it's a very small community, actually. And I think one of the advantages we have is that we're outsiders. We're not part of that community, although we do a lot of research on that community, and we hope that allows us to speak in with a very different perspective than you might get.
But groupthink also has led to a lot of similarity in product. Somebody has a hit, and the next thing you know, there are 10 other shows that look just like that. Mm-hmm. The same thing happens in the recording industry, which is suffering all sorts of other problems. But don't they understand that you have to come up with something different, or is it just too difficult?
I think it's hard to do that within the structure. So let me go back to House of Cards for a second. When Bo Williman showed the first scene of House of Cards, where Kevin Spacey strangles his neighbor's dog, to his creative team, a lot of the people who'd worked in television on the creative team said, "You can't strangle a dog in the first 90 seconds of the first episode. You're going to lose half your audience." And in fact, the data show that you lose a good deal of your audience. In television, that wouldn't have worked, but it worked for Netflix because Netflix is pursuing a fundamentally different business model. Netflix doesn't worry as much if you tune out of House of Cards because it knows you're going to watch something else on Netflix, and that's okay.
And you're paying for it.
And you're paying for it.
So you're willing to give a little more time to develop.
you want to give it a little more time to develop, and you can watch it at your own pace and on your own time, and that allows some of these shows that wouldn't have worked in another channel to work just fine on Netflix.
Michael D. Smith and Rahul Telang have written Streaming, Sharing, Stealing, Big Data, and the Future of Entertainment. It's published by MIT Press. We'll continue our conversation after this. We are back with Michael D. Smith, who with Rahul Telang has written Streaming, Sharing, Stealing, Big Data, and the Future of Entertainment. It's published by MIT Press. Your book deals largely with the business and economic side of entertainment. What can the average reader with little knowledge of economics or the entertainment business take away from it?
I hope the average reader will at least give it a look, because this is an industry that matters to all of us. You know, if you watch movies or television shows, if you benefit from these wonderful storytellers, I hope it's interesting to think about how those stories are changing in the face of technology.
You discuss what are called long-tail business models. What does that mean?
It's a concept that says, so if you go to your local Barnes & Noble superstore, you can get 100,000 books, right? They've got 100,000 books on the shelves. If you go to Amazon, it's something like 4 million. The question we asked in our research was, do consumers care about those extra 3.9 million books that you couldn't get at Barnes & Noble? And the answer is yes, and passionately so, that a lot of the value from the internet comes from these books and these obscure products that you couldn't find in your local stores. And that a big part of the value that people get from these online entertainment channels is finding exactly that right piece of content that meets their needs.
But what about the people who produce the content? Didn't Taylor Swift pull all of her music off of Spotify, feeling that the minimal royalties the streaming service earns were significantly less than their value?
Taylor, an artist like Taylor Swift has enough power
has
to pull that off. Yeah, right. And do that. And again, that too changes the face of entertainment, that the artists now have enough power to say, I'm going to pull this off and I'm going to distribute it on another channel and my customers are going to find me.
How have executives at companies like Time Warner or Comcast or Verizon responded to the success of Netflix and some of the others?
I think it's difficult to watch, in part because you know your business has always survived over the last 100 years, and it doesn't seem like what's going on today is that different. And again, one of the things we're trying to argue in the book and show our friends in the industry in the book is this is why we feel like this is a unique moment in time where things actually could be upset if you don't make a bold bet on these new technologies.
Didn't NBC make a big mistake when they ditched Apple?
That's what we see in the data, you know. And NBC, I think, based on all of their experience, could have reasonably thought that pulling the content off Apple will allow our consumers to find the content on these other legal sites. What we find in the research is when NBC pulled its television content off Apple, there was no increase in sales on Amazon, no increase in sales on NBC's own platform, and a huge increase in piracy on NBC's content. And in fact, once those people learned how to pirate, they not only pirated their NBC content, they also started to pirate ABC, CBS, and Fox content.
And then NBC reversed the decision about a year later.
And it was hard to get those people back. Mm. That's the other unfortunate thing.
And NBC has been struggling more than other networks. It used to be the dominant network. It is, to some degree, is that also because successful companies tend to want to continue doing what they've done in the past, whereas the less successful ones are willing to take chances?
This is the paradox of success, right? You get successful by being able to replicate the processes that got you success. And then when those processes need to change, it's very hard for you to change them because so much of your energy has been focused on replicating the successful processes.
Have any other companies made significant mistakes?
In the entertainment industry, do you mean?
The record business, obviously, everybody made mistakes. They're hardly is a record business anymore.
Yeah, and I guess I'm hesitant to call them mistake. You know, I'm hesitant to criticize simply because I don't know if I would do any better sitting in their shoes. These are really hard decisions and really complicated decisions.
They could not have predicted the way technology would change everything.
I think it was really hard to predict the way technology was changing things, particularly if you're sitting in the C-suite of an entertainment company trying to keep the established business going and thinking about this new business. What these folks are doing is incredibly hard.
How are the newcomers in entertainment using data that the old-timers aren't?
One of the discussions in the industry about data, there's this fear that data is going to be used to influence the creative process, and that would actually be bad for entertainment. And we believe it would. You know, I don't want to watch a show where machine learning geeks have come in and said, hey, people like to see more animals, so you need to have more animals in the second scene, right? I don't think that's going to work out well. What's interesting, though, is that's not what Netflix is doing. Kevin Spacey called his experience making House of Cards the most creatively rewarding experience of his career.
But in the past, the networks used to test shows, the pilots of shows, and often shows like All in the Family would test rather poorly. But if they took a chance on them, they could turn out to be the biggest show in America.
And this is what I think the data gives Netflix and Amazon and Google is the ability to target the content exactly to people who are likely to enjoy this content. So, for example, with House of Cards, Netflix made 9 different trailers. One was focused on Kevin Spacey fans. One was focused on David Fincher fans. They had one on people who'd watched movies with strong female leads. And they targeted that audience in a very intelligent way, and in a way that would be hard for the studios to do.
Is data collection in entertainment tied to the new devices, smartphones, tablets, the things that people are using to gain access?
Very much so. And Netflix and these other tech companies have done a wonderful job of using these new ways of watching content as a source of information about you. So Netflix knows exactly what content you watch, what device you watch it on, what time of day you watch it, and what scenes you watch over and over again.
On the other hand, when Netflix says to me, because of what you've watched, you'll probably like this other thing, I'm usually surprised by how lame the offer is. Amazon usually suggests books that I don't want to read either.
That's interesting. The one that I find really powerful is YouTube, actually. When I go to my YouTube page, they are able to present me with 13 different, you know, clips that I can suck up a good half hour of my time. You know, there's baseball and there's, you know, the Rolling Stones and all sorts of wonderful things that are tightly designed to my interest.
Because they offer you a wide range of things, even if they give you this long list. So even if you are not interested in 10 of them, there are 2 there that are almost guaranteed to attract you.
Yep. And the more I watch, the more they learn about me, the better they make their recommendations.
YouTube is part of Google. Google doesn't seem to be doing as well as YouTube.
Google just started YouTube Red, which is their version of a subscription service. They've announced plans to make 10 of their own original movies, and time will tell. It will be interesting to see how successful YouTube is with that. What they have been successful, though, is with YouTube artists by creating these YouTube stars, helping them find an audience, helping them make their content. That's where they've made their bread and butter.
Are Google's algorithms like Kentucky Fried Chicken's secret recipe?
Very much so. And this is the interesting and scary thing if you're in the entertainment industry. Google, Amazon, Netflix share almost no data about the customer. And I think, as we talk about in the book, that is their secret sauce, their ability to target the customer and understand the customer's needs.
Michael D. Smith and Rahul Telang have written Streaming, Sharing, Stealing, Big Data, and the Future of Entertainment. It's published by MIT Press. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The band Vulpak raised about $20,000 for a tour by making an album called Sleepify, which was just 10 tracks of silence totaling 5 minutes. And they asked their fans to stream the album on Spotify while they slept. the royalties added up significantly. Are there other clever ways for artists to earn real money with streaming devices?
I'm not sure that's the most productive way of entertaining yourself. But I do think there are a lot of new ways for artists to get funding. It used to be that you had to go through the record label to get that funding, and now you can use a whole bunch of these online services to get funding for different projects.
When did the entertainment industry begin to pay attention to big data? Weren't some of the early private industry data collections done by casinos, especially by the economist Gary Lubman at Harrah's?
We talk a lot about Harrah's and use Harrah's as an analogy for what we think the studios ought to be thinking about. When Gary Lubman went to Harrah's, each studio was its own separate fiefdom. They all had their own data. They didn't share that data. Gary Lubman's big innovation was to say, no, your data belongs to the corporation, and we're going to centralize data, centralize data-driven decision-making. And when he left Harrah's, the data warehouse that he put together was worth $1 billion. What we're hoping in the studios today are run with separate fiefdoms, theatrical, home entertainment, television. What we're hoping to encourage them is to take the data that resides in those fiefdoms and do some of the similar things to what Gary Lubman did at Harrah's.
Didn't he have a quite different take on consumers?
Gary Lubman?
Yeah.
He had a very quantitative take on consumers. So the conventional wisdom in the casino industry was, if I give you a free room and a free steak, that's how to get you to come back to the casino. Gary Lubman used his platform and his data to run experiments, and what he discovered is it's far more productive to give you $50 in chips than to give you $100 in free meals and free hotel rooms, and that changed a lot of the practices in the industry.
One of the popular words in the tech world is disruption. Aren't business schools and researchers studying innovation more now? Can innovation be planned?
I think innovation can be planned in the sense of learning a lot from what has been successful in the past and what hasn't been successful in the past. And that's why we try to use these different analogies in the books, analogies to Harrah's Casino and what they've done, analogies to what NBC has done. And also trying to analyze why have you had power for so long, and are those factors changing?
The NSA invaded privacy, but haven't consumers willingly thrown the doors wide open to the entertainment industry?
This has been the interesting thing. Consumers are more than willing to share the details of their viewing habits if you'll give them value in return in the form of good recommendations and access to good content. It's a value for value exchange, and both sides benefit.
But I remember that song. What was it? 500 channels and nothing to watch?
The wonderful thing about on-demand viewing, though, is you've got 10,000 channels, and you can find exactly the stuff that's going to appeal to you. And Netflix and the others are doing a pretty good job of that.
I was wondering if the NSA should just start a movie channel.
Wouldn't that be fun?
Then Snowden could come back to the United States.
Yeah, he could be the director.
How far behind the newcomers are the old established companies? Time Warner, Comcast, Verizon, Disney, Sony, they're still doing pretty well.
They're doing pretty well. They're also doing some very innovative things. I think their investment in Hulu is very innovative. NBC's investment in streaming platforms for the Olympics was very, very innovative. We're starting to see a move towards trying to get access to the customer and towards changing some of these long-established products.
It's Time Warner, Comcast, and others provide content as well as access, that makes sense to me, but doesn't that also suggest that there's a conflict of interest there?
In what sense?
Well, if you are the one who controls the access and at the same time forcing people to choose this content rather than that content.
I think this relates back to net neutrality and mm-hmm. the debates we've had around net neutrality.
There's been a big divide on net neutrality, and it's become a big political issue.
It's become a big political issue, and this is an important issue, right? We want all of our companies to behave in a way that respects the consumer. What's interesting, though, is as Netflix and Amazon and Google get more and more powerful in this space, they have the same power to direct you to something that might benefit them.
On the other hand, they're competing with Time Warner and Comcast, who have government-sanctioned control over access in over large areas. They often have a monopoly.
In terms of their access to the broadcast channels?
Well, you move into a neighborhood and you're told this is a Time Warner neighborhood. You move into another one and it's Fios is the only provider of internet access, of cable service. So they're not competing.
They're competing in a lot of markets, and I think new technologies are giving consumers new ways to access the content. So, for example, even if you get your internet service through Comcast, you can still use that Comcast pipe to subscribe to Netflix and subscribe to a variety of different channels. You're right. There's certainly risks here, but I think there are a lot of opportunities for technology to continue to give consumers choice.
Consumers may be concerned about companies collecting data. Are companies concerned about us collecting theirs, either through hacking, like what happened at Sony in 2014, or through piracy?
Of course, the studios are understandably very, very concerned about piracy. It's not, and again, piracy, the problem isn't just that it hurts sales. The problem is that it damages the profitability of all the business models that the studios have used by creating these windows where you can't watch the content until this period. Piracy makes it harder to execute all of those business models.
And Representative Lamar Smith introduced the Stop Online Piracy Act, SOPA, in 2011,
which died in Congress because of surprisingly strong resistance from the tech companies, which I think was a wake-up call to everybody that the tech companies wield a lot more political clout than anyone, at least at that time, expected.
I want to thank you so much for being on our show.
It was very much my pleasure.
Michael D. Smith and Rahul Talang, their book, Streaming, Sharing, Stealing, Big Data, and the Future of Entertainment, is published by MIT Press. Michael Smith is the Carnegie Mellon Professor of what?
Information Technology and Marketing.
It's been a great pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.